Dakota access what they call their own land, but really is our land as a Chetishakoan people. We enacted a form of eminent domain, claiming the land back for ourselves as Chetishakoan folks. And we set up a beautiful encampment on that piece of property, which severely threatened Dakota Access and obviously Morton County Sheriff for their intents to build this pipeline. And so they came in with a large force. And you described, you know, a lot of the equipment that was there, and it was terrifying. I mean, we had elders, women, and children who were put at severe risk because of the actions of law enforcement. A lot of folks know the Ponca leader Casey Camp. She stood in defiance and peaceful prayer in front of an armored personnel carrier, because she loved the land and wanted to protect the Missouri River, not just for the Standing Rock Sioux Nation, but for all nations and all people and the millions of people who depend on the Missouri River for drinking water. So this movement is not founded out of hate for the police officers or for the workers themselves, but out of love for the land and for all of us as human beings. That's why we're there. That's not, our enemy is not the worker. Our enemy is not the police. It's the corporations that are hell-bent on poisoning Mother Earth and disconnecting ourselves even further from the sacred integrity of the land and the water.
That's Dallas Goldtooth of the Dakota and Dene Nations. He works with the Indigenous Environmental Network. Special thanks to Laura Gottesdiener, John Hamilton, and Dennis Moynihan. To view all our coverage of the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance and the standoff at Standing Rock, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, Tarina Nadura, and Andre Lewis. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee are engineers. Special thanks to John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan, Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:01 a.m. Coming up on TUC Radio, author Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz explains the role of military in the suppression of the re-education of Native people. At 8:30, it's Making Contact, Native Power, Language, Land, and Water. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. A new smartphone app is available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Radio is currently hiring for the following three positions: Station Manager, Evening News and Public Affairs Director, and Director of Underwriting. To apply to one of these positions, send a cover letter and resume to hiring@kboo.org, or bring or mail your resume with cover letter to 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer the following question: why is KBOO important? Open until filled. Interviews will begin around December 9th. No phone calls, please. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. For more information, go to kboo.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual Flash holiday show, running December 8th through 11th at the Alberta Abbey in Portland. Based on the 80s cult classic film Flash Gordon, Flash is Portland's premier rock opera parody, complete with a live rock band, Mercury Rising, formed at the School of Rock. Again, that's the third annual Flash holiday show, running December 8th through 11th at the Alberta Abbey, 126 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. an Indigenous People's History of the United States. This is the second part of a one-hour program with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. She grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Indian mother. She holds a PhD in history and is an activist in the international Indigenous movement. Her book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, was published to high acclaim in the fall of 2014, in part rewriting the official history of the U.S. Dunbar Ortiz is looking for reasons why the founding ideology of the U.S. proved so deadly for the indigenous peoples living here. She explains how the early settlers considered themselves to be the chosen people and claimed a covenant with God that is later expressed in the U.S. Constitution. A little known and astounding fact is that to this day, the U.S. follows the doctrine of discovery developed by the Pope for Portugal and Spain, and then used by the modern colonial powers. The doctrine of discovery treats indigenous land as unoccupied and ready for the taking as long as Christians were not present. Even the status and definition of a human was based on religion. The U.S. Supreme Court, as recently as 2005, relied on the doctrine of discovery to limit the sovereignty of the Oneida Nation. Here's Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz with a brief reading from the chapter on the cult of the covenant.
Although the U.S. Constitution represents for many U.S. citizens a covenant with God, the U.S. origin story goes back to the Mayflower Compact, the first governing document of the Plymouth Colony, named for the ship that carried the 100 or so passengers to what is now Cape Cod, Massachusetts, in November 1620. 41 of the so-called pilgrims, all men, and they were Calvinists, of course, wrote and signed the compact. Invoking God's name and declaring themselves loyal subjects of the king, the signatories announced that they had journeyed to Northern Virginia, as the eastern seaboard of North America was called by the English, to plant the first colony, and did therefore covenant and combine ourselves together in a civil body politic to be governed by just and equal laws enacted for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience. The original settlers of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, founded in 1630, adopted an official seal designed in England before their journey. The central image depicts a near-naked native holding a harmless, flimsy bow and arrow and inscribed with a plea, "Come over and help us." Nearly 300 years later, the official seal of the U.S. military veterans of the Spanish-American War, that is the invasion, occupation of Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines, showed a naked woman kneeling before an armed U.S. soldier and a sailor with a U.S. battleship in the background. One may trace this recurrent altruistic theme into the early 21st century, when the United States still invades countries under the guise of rescue. In other modern constitutional states, constitutions come and go, and they're never considered sacred in the manner patriotic U.S. citizens venerate theirs. Great Britain has no written constitution, so they didn't get it from the British. The Magna Carta arguably comes close, but it does not reflect a covenant. The U.S. Constitution, the Mayflower Compact, the Declaration of Independence, the writings of the so-called Founding Fathers, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, the Pledge of Allegiance, which was written in the 1880s, and even Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech are all bundled into the covenant as sacred documents that express the U.S. state religion. An aspect of this most visible in the early 21st century is the burgeoning gun lobby, based on the sanctity of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. In the forefront of the Second Amendment adherents are the descendants of the old settlers who say that they represent the people and have the right to bear arms in order to overthrow any government that does not, in their view, adhere to the God-given covenant. From its beginning, the United States has welcomed, indeed even often solicited and even bribed, immigrants to repopulate conquered territories cleansed of their indigenous inhabitants. From the mid-19th century, immigrants were recruited to work mines, raise forests, construct canals and railroads, and labor in sweatshops, factories, and commercial farm fields. In the late 20th century, technical and medical workers were recruited. Their requirements for formal citizenship were simple, and are simple now. Adhere to the sacred covenant through taking the citizenship oath, pledging loyalty to the flag, and regarding those outside the covenant as enemies or potential enemies of the exceptional country that has adopted them, often after they have escaped hunger, war, or repression, which in turn were often caused by U.S. militarism or economic sanctions. Yet no matter how much immigrants might strive to prove themselves to be as hardworking and patriotic as descendants of the original settlers, and despite the rhetoric of "we are all one people," they are suspect. The old stock against which they are judged inferior includes not only those who fought in the 15-year war for independence from Britain, but also, and perhaps more important, those who fought and shed Indian blood before and after independence in order to acquire the land. These are the descendants of the English Pilgrims, Scots, Scots-Irish, and Huguenot French, Calvinists all, who took the land bequeathed to them in the Sacred Covenant that predated the creation of the independent United States. So the land won through North American bloodshed was not necessarily conceived in terms of particular parcels for a farm that would be passed down through generations. Most of the settlers who fought for it kept moving on nearly every generation. In the South, many lost their holdings to land companies that then sold it to planters seeking to increase the size of their slave-worked plantations. Without the unpaid forced labor of enslaved Africans, a farmer growing cash crops could not compete on the market. Once in the hands of settlers, the land itself was no longer sacred as it had been for the indigenous. Rather, it was private property, a commodity to be acquired and sold. Every man a possible king, or at least wealthy. Later, when Anglo-Americans had occupied the continent or urbanized much of it, this quest for land and the sanctity of private property were reduced to a lot with a house on it, and the land came to mean the country, the flag, the military, as in the land of the free, of the national anthem, or Woody Guthrie's "This Land Is Your Land." Those who died fighting in foreign wars were said to have sacrificed their lives to protect this land that the old settlers had spilled blood to acquire. The blood spilled was largely indigenous. These then were the settlers upon which the national myths are based, the ultimately dispensable cannon fodder for the taking of the land and the continent. They were not of the ruling class, although a few slipped through and later were drawn in by the ruling class as elected officials and military officers, thereby maintaining the facade of a classless society and a democratic empire. The founders themselves and the elite were English patricians, slave owners, large land barons, or otherwise successful businessmen dependent on the slave trade and exports produced by enslaved Africans and on property sales. When descendants of the settler class, overwhelmingly Presbyterian or otherwise Calvinist Protestant, were accepted into the ruling class, they almost always became Episcopalians, members of an elite church linked to the state Church of England. As we look at the bloody deeds of the settlers in acquiring and maintaining land, the social class context is an essential element.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz reading from the chapter on the Cult of the Covenant from her 2014 book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. A person in the audience asked about the role of the military in the suppression and re-education of Native peoples, and why so many Indians enlist in the military.
That's colonialism. There's still a colonial condition. All of the laws of the United States put in place, its brand of colonialism, each colonialism is a little bit different. It was first put within the Department of War, and it was militarily organized. These concentration camps surrounded by the military, and they became then civilianized, going to the Department of Interior, but with the same legal basis and the doctrine of discovery, that colonial instrument used. The Vatican proclaimed in 1454. For the Portuguese to invade and enslave the people of West Africa for the begin launching of the slave trade. Then after Columbus' voyage for the Spanish monarchs, another papal bull in 1494 included Spain in this doctrine of discovery. And then all the other colonizing powers adopted it as their legal basis. This is the first Western international law, was the doctrine of discovery. The United States is the only country in the world that still codifies the doctrine of discovery. Supreme Court decisions in the 1820s that codified it are still in effect and are the colonial institutions that control. Now, that along with the boarding schools, which were begun, some of them in the 1830s, by different churches that were given contracts to be, the on-site colonizers, some of the people east of the Mississippi, especially among the Seneca, the Iroquois in upstate New York. But then in 1870s were introduced as federal boarding schools. They still had some religious ones always, farmed out contract. But they all behaved in the same way as a very regimented military style. At first they were just boys, and later they took girls. But in both cases they were extremely militarized. Native people were forced. They would send soldiers to take the children if people didn't turn the children in to be transported, sometimes way across the country. At first, there was only one in Pennsylvania, so people were being transported a long ways from west of the Mississippi. And then over 200 of them were established. Right now, there's a whole boarding school project to gather the testimony of this kind of generational trauma caused by being taken away from your family for 10 years, de-Indianized completely, haircut, no religious or cultural aspects to linger, and worst of all, just horrible abuse. They put different tribes together, and English was the only language allowed. They would be beaten for speaking their own language. So you have generations of people traumatized this way. Native people who have federal recognition have never been subject to the draft, to conscription, but they have always enlisted, volunteered, in percentages greater than any other ethnic group. And a part of this is that it's encouraged, it was encouraged in the boarding schools to go straight then into the army. Go fight in the Philippines, go fight in the European wars.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, author of in Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States. The next question was about an earlier book by her, The Great Sioux Nation, published in 1977, came out of the 1974 Wounded Knee Trials, where Dunbar Ortiz was an expert witness. In 1973, the American Indian Movement had been asked by Lakota elders to come to the Pine Ridge Reservation to help protect them from the death squads of a corrupt tribal leader, Richard Wilson. They had tried to democratically impeach Wilson, but failed because he had the protection of the U.S. government. In February 1973, AIM and Lakota began an armed takeover of Wounded Knee in memory of the 1890 massacre of Wounded Knee of Lakota women, children, and elders. The occupation resulted in a 71-day siege by federal forces that encircled them. During the siege, federal officers and AIM members exchanged gunfire almost nightly. Hundreds of arrests were made, and two Native Americans were killed, and a federal marshal was permanently paralyzed. The leaders of AIM finally surrendered on May 8, after a negotiated settlement was reached. U.S. District Judge Warren K. Urbaum presided over the trials of Native activists in 1974. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz acted as expert witness. Here's her remembrance.
The Great Sioux Nation was my first book in 1977. And it came out of the Wounded Knee Trials. All of the people who came out of Wounded Knee were arrested and charged with various felonies and misdemeanors. So it just tied the movement up. Each one after another, were dismissed, or the people found not guilty. A few people served some jail time. It was just kind of purposely putting the American Indian Movement to great expense, raising money for court cases and not being able to organize in the communities. So we decided to have these remaining cases, I think there were about 90 of them left, that they all be dismissed on the basis of this treaty that said that any crimes committed in the Great Sioux Nation, the people were subject to punishment by Sioux authorities. And this was when the Great Sioux Nation was a contiguous land base that covered all of North and South Dakota, or some of Wyoming and Montana, and much of Nebraska. And that had, you know, has been broken down into seven separate little reservations within that. The largest amount of that land taken away when the Black Hills were the sacred area of the Sioux were taken illegally. And that was actually because of AIM and Wounded Knee and the Sioux Treaty hearing in 1980, the Supreme Court accepted a case and found that the Black Hills were taken illegally. But the federal government only pays money compensation, not restoration of land. So the Sioux refused to take the money, and now it's up to something like almost $2 billion in a trust fund that the poorest people in the Western Hemisphere refused to take because they want the land back. So that's still a struggle going on. And that was one of the reasons for the Wounded Knee occupation, one of the demands, and in general, that the United States should honor that treaty. So this hearing that was held in Lincoln, Nebraska in December 1974 was just about this time of year. I was an expert witness and also on the legal team with Vine Deloria and, you know, a bunch of other lawyers, we decided to, or the people decided to insist that the judge allow this oral history to be told by the elder Sioux people. Some of them medicine people, some of them traditional chiefs. So we had 2 weeks of hearings, and the judge allowed that. He allowed swearing on the medicine bag instead of the Bible. It was just became a native courtroom, you know. Even though the motion was denied on the basis that that it was only Congress that could make such a decision on a treaty, because it was Congress that approved treaties, he did make the statement, the judge, that they should take it to international. So that's exactly what they did right after that. Took it as a centerpiece to the United Nations. And that was the beginning of the UN work. So at the end of the hearing, I was surrounded by several of the elder people, and I had done a lot of testimony and a lot of work and a lot of expert witness testimony. It was not my specialization. The Southwest and Oklahoma was my specialization in history, and, you know, and historians really stick with their specializations, you know. Well, that didn't last long, because they asked me to work this up, all this testimony from the court records, into a book. I said, we think you could do this because you're a historian. And they liked my testimony. They trusted me. And I said, tried to get out of it. And there's no way you could say no to that. So for the next 3 years, I worked on that book, and it was published in 1977. And I got the 5,000-page court reporter's records. You know, they sit there and they type. They're pretty amazing, you know, how they can. But they didn't have problems with the ones who used the Lakotas who used a translator. There was a very good Lakota bilingual man there, but some of these elders didn't speak English. So he was very clear in his translation, so she didn't have any problem with that. But the old medicine man, Henry Crow Dog, he insisted on speaking English because he thought he wanted to express it exactly like he wanted to. When I was listening to him talk, I understood every word. I was even taking some notes. It was so brilliant. And he spoke almost nonstop for about 2 hours. But when I got the court records, it was just gibberish. She couldn't make out what he was saying. And I realized I was listening to it because I had learned to, you know, kind of understand his interesting English. And he used to, because he had been forced to, in boarding school, to read the Bible and everything. So he used a lot of language from Revelations, and me being raised a Southern Baptist, I was familiar, you know, with those images of Revelations. And he was predicting apocalypse for the United States. And there's nothing better than Revelations for scary apocalypse. So it was clear to me, but she phonetically spelled everything he said. But in written form, this was, you know, was not English, it was not anything. I did know that that was the most important testimony. And then I met Simon Ortiz, who's a poet from Acoma Pueblo. And I showed it to him, and I told him the story about Henry Crow Dog's testimony and how it's just essential. I just felt like he had summarized, you know, he gave a summary of all 2 weeks. And you would have thought he slept the whole time. He had his eyes closed. looking like he was dozing the whole time for 2 weeks. But when he spoke, he was summarizing everything, and it was just brilliant. So Simon started looking at it, and he got at his typewriter and started typing it and putting it in poetry form. And then he could make out what the words were that she had spelled phonetically, what she heard, but could guess at it. So he was able to translate it, and we then checked it with Henry and with Severt Young Bear, the translator, to make sure this was his, these were his intention. So that's in the book, and I divided it up because he was summarizing, and I divided it up into different parts of the book as the beginning of each chapter. So it's a really, really interesting book. One of these days I plan to make some kind of website where I'll put all of, the whole court proceedings up, because it is an interesting process. So thank you for asking about the Great Sioux Nation.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, author of the 2014 Beacon Press book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. I recorded her on December 4, 2014 at Green Apple, one of the last used bookstores in San Francisco. Her 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was the fundamental document at the first International Conference on Indigenous Peoples of the Americas. That conference was held at the United Nations headquarters in Geneva. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a part Indian mother and a tenant farmer. After receiving her PhD in history at the University of California, Los Angeles, she taught in the newly established Native American Studies program at Cal State Hayward, and helped found the Departments of Ethnic and Women's Studies there. Dunbar-Ortiz is the author or editor of 7 other books, including Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, Red Dirt, Growing Up Oki, and Blood on the Border, Memoir of the Contra War. She lives in San Francisco. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. If you're unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.
That was TUC Radio, and the interview was with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, explaining the role of military in the suppression and re-education of Native people in the U.S. Coming up right now at 8:30, it's Making Contact, Native Power, Language, Land, and Water.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Aftermath, part of the Brown Paper series produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs November 28th at 7 p.m. at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. In Mary Burrell's 1919 one-act, John Thornton, a young black soldier who has served his country in World War I, comes home to rural South Carolina. His homecoming is disrupted when he learns that someone close to him has been lynched by a white mob. Again, that's Aftermath, produced by Triangle Productions, November 28th at 7 p.m. at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 50K. Yeah. I'm the only one live, yeah. I have no idea. They keep cutting me in and out.
Kevin Gilbert's smartphone tries to balance out the harsh brightness of police spotlights and the blackness of night. Any trace of celestial light are flooded out. There's a trail of stopped cars along the highway. It's unknown if these cars are support for water protectors or police.
So you're looking at the bridge on 1806, and right now these are peaceful, unarmed water protectors being fired upon with tear gas, mace, a water cannon, concussion grenades, and rubber bullets. They're in an enclosed space where they cannot escape left or right. They're on a bridge. So when the tear gas goes in there, the only option is inhale tear gas or trample each other. Right now, you'll see the families staying together and they're inhaling tear gas. They're not trampling each other. They're about to unleash the LRAD, which is the noise cannon, which disorientates people. These are peaceful, unarmed people that you are watching. I can't get a better picture for you, but you'll see on the lights on the hill in the background are the force after force of the militarized police.
This was on Sunday, November 20, heading into Thanksgiving week. It's the stand against the 1,172-mile Dakota Access Pipeline that started after the pipeline's approval in July this year. There are no signs of federal government intervention this evening, and it's likely that things may get worse during the harsh winter. But the thousands of water protectors, a mix of young and old, indigenous and immigrant, make their stand.
Bernie Sanders shared my live feed. Thank you, Bernie. Just keep sharing this and watching this, because this is unarmed civilians being fired on by militarized police. The water cannon, it's sub-zero temperature right now. My friend just went up there to take blankets to the people so that they don't get hypothermia. She was tear gassed so hard she puked and she peed her pants, because you cannot get out of there. And this is what they're doing to peaceful, unarmed people right now on American soil. This is what your tax dollars is paying for. If you don't like what you're seeing, keep sharing it. Contact the White House, contact the Army Corps of Engineers, look at who's supporting energy transfer partners, and take your money out of those. This is a public road that's blocked.
This week on Making Contact, we bring you voices from the water protectors at Standing Rock. Afterwards, we hear from Making Contact community storytelling fellow, Vincent Medina, who shares his personal journey to help keep Chochenyo Ohlone culture and language alive. In between violent encounters precipitated by police, the communities that have united and organized are diverse. And just as diverse are the motivations drawing people towards the fight to protect land and water. Some of these stories are being documented by a grassroots media group called Voices of Standing Rock. These oral histories are revelatory, deeply personal, and deeply political. We share one of these voices, Audrey De La Rosa, a Native American from Kayenta, Arizona, who had to make a critical life choice to join the struggle at Standing Rock.
Me coming home to the reservation, that's my personal conflict, choosing between the Red Road versus the Western Road. My great-grandfather has land up in the mountains of Winder Rock, where my grandma's originally from. It's like, do I go to Winder Rock and like eventually build my home, learning my language, knowing these traditions, or do I go to Washington and go be a program director for the LGBTQ community with $40,000 a year with benefits? That was 2 weeks ago I got that job offered. And I was like, no, I'm good. And, you know, majority of people were like, are you crazy? This is like what every millennial is trying to do. And you're turning it down? I love going to sweat lodges every Saturday and talking to the other woman. I love going to ceremonies and staying up night chanting and singing and hearing my native language spoken and having spiritual experiences and having teachings from older generations. The elders are like, enjoy yourself when you're young, indulge in it, be fast, go run, go explore these mountains, go do all that you can, because one of these days you're going to be old and your hands are going to come in together, your joints are going to hurt. And he's like, go indulge it, go enjoy it, go do all that you can. It was told me, it was like, you know, if you believe in something to fight for it, go get up and go do it. You know, you don't need permission. You don't need to tell everybody what you're doing. You don't need to be recognized. You know, that humility, that humbleness. I've always seen that in my grandparents. They've always helped out people, but nobody knew where that help came from. And I've always admired that. So I adopted that into my own doctrine and constitution. And I really treasure those teachings, because you only get your grandparents once. When you sit, especially as a young person, you're sitting in a way to know that you may have to get up and go do something. Maybe somebody's about to have a baby, or maybe somebody needs some sort of medicine. Maybe a message needs to go up. But if you're a young, able person, your back better be straight. You better be sitting in a position where if you have to get up and start running, you better go. So in that way, I was sitting upright and ready to go. And when the opportunity came, I was like, this is what I'm doing. The day before, I was like, so I'm going to Standing Rock. And they're like, why? And I was like, because history is being made and I want to be part of it, and knowing that I contributed. I'm here, I'm able, you know, and if I see somebody chopping wood, no problem, I'll go over there. And if you need help with cooking, no problem. As an academic scholar, I've written my own academic papers of how social change begins on the reservation, and it's happening. I came here to listen for their teachings, for their narratives, their conversations, and maybe it will spark a solution. I came home to give back to my community, looking at the potential of like what could happen with the reservation. It's being from a cross-country coach to economics, biology teacher, just kind of jack of all trades in education. And I think that's really my main thing, was going to school and coming back and giving the kids the truth of what college is like. Having a professor cross out your paper and call it rubbish and shove it back at you, you know, you're just kind of like, all right, I'll try it again. That's why I keep telling my communities, like, don't be afraid to fail. It's like, you're going to cry, but so what? You know, get up, try it again, fail again. You gotta fail a lot to learn how to do everything that you're gonna do. You're gonna be, have a lot of rocks chucked at you in the academic Western world, but you gotta learn how to laugh, learn how to be flexible, learn how to be patient, learn how to be transformative, and if there's work to be done, don't be told what to do, get up and go do it.
Back in April, a group of Lakota Sioux women from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe were crucial figures in starting the Sacred Stones Camp when they prayed that the waters remain pure. The camp has grown beyond the Lakota Sioux women, but they've inspired many other women to show support with their presence. We hear from S of the First Nations, who came all the way out from Toronto, Canada.
I got really sad because I knew how much the Lakota people would sacrifice to protect their land, because they have throughout history, right? They have a long history of resistance and protecting the Black Hills and the Badlands and up, you know, territory all through here. And I was very restless at home. And so we drove from Toronto, jumped in the car, we were on the road by 4 a.m. and we drove straight through to South Dakota. My community had an occupation and protest and resistance. And so I knew what it was like as well to sit and on the front lines of your territory and have police and riot gear marching towards you. We had blocked off the road, and then about 100 meters away was about 100 people from the town. You know, as Indigenous people, as we were resisting the colonial violence, I think the town really saw it as an attack against them, when it really wasn't. But that anger that they had really became tangible. They were throwing rocks, they were throwing beer bottles, they were yelling racial slurs. There was OPP and riot gear that came marching in. Full riot gear on their helmets, their assault rifles. And there was about 100 of them. And all the white people started cheering for them, yelling and screaming all these things. And I was like 18 at the time. And I remember sitting there and being like, I'm gonna get beat up now. Like, you know what I mean? We're gonna get arrested. No one really moved we sat there and there was people drumming and they continued to drum. And the OPP came and walked in and they formed a line across the road. And they lined up between Native protesters and the white protesters. And they turned and they faced the white people. And they put their backs towards the Native people. It took a second for people to catch on what was happening. And then the white protesters were like, "You're facing the wrong way." And it's like, well, no, like, these struggles aren't always that narrative. You know, it's not cowboys versus Indians. You know, it's not that kind of idea anymore, right? People don't really empathize with Indigenous people because there's that kind of perception of a stoic Indian person. It's hard to understand how deeply grieving a lot of our communities are. The underpinnings of all of this are in Europe, you know, in 1093 or 1094 when the Papal Bulls made it so that non-Christian lands was terra nullius. Like, that's the legal basis, right, that was used to colonize North America. And the Indigenous people here were non-Christians, and so it was like this land wasn't occupied. And so that premise and underpinning was the logic that was used to destroy whole cultures and nations. America, Canada, as countries, require the illegitimacy of Indigenous peoples to be able to justify their existence and their governance over the land. Because Indigenous communities are still actively experiencing colonization, they still experience trauma. Because that's a lot of people say, right? They're like, oh, you should just, you know, go home and get over it. And well, it's hard to get over something that's still actively happening, you know, or that's something that you have to worry about happening tomorrow. You can't really get over that impending harm. The more that struggle exists, the more vulnerable Indigenous people are made. Women in the structure are especially vulnerable because they experience, you know, Western colonial gender violence. I joke that I have like one of those signs up in my cubicle that says, like, it has been this many days since I've cried at work, and it's usually less than a few. In 2014, there was 1,182 Indigenous women that have been murdered in Canada since the 1980s, and even more that are missing. There's a disproportionate amount of Indigenous women that are missing because they don't have access to justice. They don't have access to a police force that's willing to look for them or to do an investigation that's going to find them. And so you see a lot of women missing where other women, the police would still be looking for them. Canadians become fatigued to seeing another report of a missing woman or a murdered Indigenous woman, but those communities live with that grief for years. I know women that are missing. I know women that have been murdered. And so what I do is advocate for policy and programming and responses that's going to end systemic violence against Indigenous women. That's a really strong way that I can support the self-determination of my nation and support the self-determination of other Indigenous nations. You know, the strength of Indigenous cultures is dependent on the health of women and how children are raised. I wouldn't want to presume to speak for any other nation and their culture and their experience with colonialism, but I do support them by coming to hear them. And even if that means sitting in the rain in a tent, I feel like that's the least I can do for a nation that has supported me so much in my identity and how I've grown into a person.
You just heard a sample of interviews, courtesy of Voices of Standing Rock. If you're interested in listening to more or learning more about the group, please visit their website on Facebook. Search for Voices of Standing Rock. You're listening to Making Contact, and today we bring you narratives from several Native American communities, from Standing Rock to the Bay, with the Ohlone. The Ohlone are the first people of the Bay Area. They covered the coastline in San Francisco and lived as far inland as Salinas Valley. After genocide and subjugation by the Spanish, the Ohlone were all but completely eradicated and enveloped within the New World. Their languages and culture criminalized and swallowed up. It would be several generations before the Ohlone would be able to regenerate and reclaim fractions of their land, elements of their culture. Making Contact Community Storytelling Fellow Vincent Medina is part of the current generation of Ohlone that are deeply invested in language and cultural revitalization. Whether fighting for sacred shell mounds in Berkeley or teaching Chochenyo language courses at Mission San Jose, Vincent finds firm footing in his deep running roots.
Uyakish ro te mak warep tak ro te payan hitkanakshe. Aye payan hitkanakshe amashmite ya payan muekma aloni. Imhen truhi toekshek ma watin makruaitka aye kik ne mak wetrish payan hitkanakshe ya watin. Makwetrish kik ne mayan.
Our language almost vanished from the earth. In 1921, in the midst of this tragedy, an elderly woman living in the deep brown canyons of Sinol named Angela de los Colos proclaimed with defiance, Kana akwe tak yuwa tak nanwente. As for me, I am not going to stop speaking. She, along with the also aging Jose Guzman, worked frantically to record, speak, and protect Chochenyo, the language spoken in the East Bay since time immemorial, which was on the brink of death, the precipice of never being used again. What a world that must have been. I can only imagine, but my heart begins to ache at the thought. These people, my elders, my heroes, they made a conscious decision to keep speaking Chochenyo, and to fight against time as though in the defiance of gravity. They knew they were the only ones who could protect our language, and they lunged, ducked, and leapt over the hurdles of reality in order to keep the flicker of light from moving into ashes and darkness. Angela and Jose, they weren't going out without a fight. Yellow parchment papers became full of frantic scribbles, an outpour of heartbreak, family histories, gossip, lore, loss and victories, and stories that stretch back to the very beginning of time, described with such an intimacy and an immediacy that they seem to have happened yesterday. Tales of a time when giants roamed the East Bay, when coyote left his footprints embedded in the earth, when hills and spirits had emotions and proper names, when bodies of stone were defeated in the underworlds, and when songs were sung just about Mount Diablo and Mission Peak. Don't forget this, I picture them telling us. Don't give up on this.
All right, now let's read these words together, okay? Just so we can get the pronunciation. So for day, truhi.
Truhi.
No, try again. Truhi.
Truhi.
Try it with your tongue a little bit further back in your throat. Truhi.
Truhi.
He'e. Orshe. Rakat.
Rakat.
Say it a little bit longer. Rakat.
Rakat. My name is Gabriel Medina and I'm 13 years old. I've been learning around 2 years. It's like a secret language. I was in fourth grade and we were doing the mission project and we were learning about Native American Indians, and I told my teacher that I was Native American, and she said that I wasn't because I didn't look Native American, and she knows what a Native American looks like. It's her opinion. I know that I am, though.
I realized just the sounds of the language were something incredible on its own. Being able to connect those old sounds to places here in the East Bay, you could hear the land in the language itself. You know, wherever you're at here in this place, you can often just see like those drops and rises and falls that make the Bay Area what it is, and that's so embedded within our language. It helped me connect in a way to my ancestors that just the words strictly on their own might not. There's context that's there. It tells people who are related. It tells the conditions that people had to go through. It tells the experiences that people had and how people consistently survived and adapted to the changes around them and kept intact what they could in order to keep their culture strong and alive. And when I would read that and connect that with the words, connect that with living in my land, and the fact that Gabriel and myself, you know, two brothers, we both We're born in our traditional village. We're meant to be in our homeland. We're meant to be speaking this language. Our elders, they're our guiding forces in many ways. They are linked to the old world that our ancestors lived in.
When you go to the language, because I know that you've been to one of the language classes that we had here, when you use some of the Chochenyo words, how does it make you feel when you use them?
Oh, I feel that I'm not saying them properly.
You know what? Surprisingly, and I talked about this with one of the professors that I have at UC Berkeley that I work with. And out of everybody, when we were having that class that first time, you got the pronunciation the closest to the way that I hear the old people say it in the recordings.
Oh, really?
And it was because I think that you probably heard stuff growing up. So somewhere back there in your mind, it's still there. But when you would get the sounds, there's a sounds that I can't get when I pronounce things that you...
Well, Aunt Dottie, in many ways, she's like the matriarch of our family.
It must be because you heard it growing up.
Probably so. You know, some words stick and some words don't. And some words you can't get them out.
Yeah.
You know, as hard as you try.
She's a tough lady. She's a strong lady. And she's always been somebody who's carried culture forward for us. She's always, and throughout her life, found ways to protect our identity. And she's always found ways to make sure that those who are around are proud to be Ohlone. In the 1960s, Aunt Dottie was the one who led our cemetery being saved near Mission San Jose.
Well, the only person that I ever heard speak the language would be Uncle Dottie. Mm-hmm. And there were some other family members that came from Livermore that also spoke the language. But to say that I ever remembered what they said, you know, I couldn't repeat it because I don't know the language.
She listened to the old timers who lived on the old Sunol Rancheria and listened to them speak the language, listened to them tell the old stories that stretch back to the very beginning.
Proud of yourself that has you've taken this upon yourself to be able to teach the younger people the language. Which something that we never had, you know, only bits and pieces now and then, but nothing that ever stuck to us because we were too busy with other thoughts.
Yeah, I understand.
You know,
Kathy, she's a really unique person because she's able to know a whole lot about the old ways, and Kathy also has a lot of insight about my great grandmother, Mary Archuleta, who, for a brief time while she was in college, she lived with her in the 1970s. When I spoke with Kathy, Kathy was telling me that she could remember hearing our language spoken all the way into the 1950s. She could remember her mother, Maggie Peanuts, and my great-grandmother standing around, and she could hear the language. I just remember thinking to myself, how much pride and how excited I felt to know that my great-grandmother, somebody who held me in her arms, that she might have been a speaker of our language in her younger years.
There we go.
Okay, so basically I just wanted to ask you a few questions just about Nana, and especially what she was like in your younger years when you were when you lived with her. One thing I always wondered about, especially with Nana, because I know that she spent time in the orphanage at the mission, and I know that her mom, Victoria Marine, passed away when she was very young over in Sunol. And the stories that I hear from my grandma about this was that things got really hard when she entered the orphanage, where she was separated from her sister, Flora. And there was obviously some really rough things that happened. But I wondered, especially because when I was a kid, Nana was always so proud to be Indian. She was always so proud about who she was, and she would always tell us, you know, that we're Ohlone. And I wonder how she was able to carry on all of that pride in her culture, even with the things that she had to go through that were painful. And
she was a lot like my grandmother, Aralinda.
Yeah.
The both of them were in Maggie Juarez and Pete Juarez's house. They were living with them. Okay, evidently they must have. My great great aunt. I guess she would be my great great aunt, Maggie Peanuts. I get what they called her Peanuts, but it was Maggie Juarez. She's the one that took them, I believe, out of the orphanage. And I guess because your Nana was chosen and not the rest of them, that may have caused, you know, the conflict or the bad feelings, you know. But they used to get called to for the meat, the buffalo meat, okay. And when every year when they would get called, she would make the calls to everybody, and we were one of the families. We'd all get together and we'd go to Ohlone Park, and we would all celebrate. We'd all be dancing. Mike loved to dance. Your Nana made all of his regalia, all of his clothing, okay. My sister Margaret is your Nana's godmother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
oh.
So that's how close we were, you know. And your Nana would make things and give it to my sister because that was her godchild.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Did, with Nana, so you could remember that there was times so that the Aralinda and Maggie Peanuts, they would speak the language, right?
Yeah. Can you kind of keep them guys quiet?
There were birds that were very loud in the background. And I remember when I would go to see my great-grandmother as a child, there would be birds that would always be everywhere in her house. And the same birds were in Kathy's as well. Oh, glorious fighters, stubborn ancestors, people of defiance, people of wisdom, gravity breakers. Today, as a result of your refusal to surrender our language,